From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with James Risen about the impact of the domestic eavesdropping story that he and Eric Lischblau broke in the New York Times. They reveal that the National Security Agency was authorized by President Bush to monitor the international phone calls and emails of Americans linked to terrorists. Two Senate committees are now preparing to investigate the program, two civil rights groups are preparing lawsuits, and the Bush administration is defending the eavesdropping program. We'll also talk with Risen about other secret programs he uncovers in his new book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Miles Davis box set. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Risen, is the New York Times reporter whose new book describes the National Security Agency's secret domestic eavesdropping program. It's a story he broke in the New York Times last month with Times reporter Eric Lischblau. We're going to talk about the impact this revelation has had and examine other secret programs Risen uncovers in his new book. It's called State of War, the Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Let's start with the NSA story. In 2002, a few months after the September 11th attacks, President Bush authorized the National Security Agency to monitor the international phone calls and emails of Americans linked to suspected terrorists, without first getting warrants. The day after the story was published in the Times, President Bush admitted that he'd authorized the program and said that revealing the existence of the secret program damages our national security. The president continues to defend the program. Did you expect that the president would confirm the existence of the secret surveillance program that you uncovered?
No, actually, I was kind of surprised by that. The day our story ran in the New York Times, the first day, the White House refused to say anything. And so I kind of thought that was going to be their strategy. And then I was surprised. I think it was a Saturday morning the president came out and kind of issued a statement confirming it. And I guess they changed their public relations strategy overnight.
Why do you think he did confirm the program? Do you have any clue?
Well, I think they've decided, as you see this week, they're rolling out a series of press events to defend the program, and leading up to the president's visit to the NSA on Wednesday. I think they've decided to kind of aggressively support and defend his decision to authorize this program. And that I guess, you know, Karl Rove talked about this on, I think it was on Friday.
Yes.
I gather they've made a calculation that politically, you know, they can defend this and to kind of make the case that this is necessary part of the war on terrorism. And so I think they're going to be more aggressively supporting it and defending it publicly.
I'm going to ask you to explain the technology that makes it possible for NSA to be doing the kind of surveillance you discovered it was doing.
I'm no technical expert, but my understanding from talking to people about this is that what they're doing is they've gotten access to the key major telecommunications switches. I guess the easiest way to think of them is they're at the interface between the domestic telecommunications network and the international telecommunications networks, and that as phone calls, cell phone calls, emails all get routed in and out of the United States, a lot of them have to go through these switches. They're kind of like gateways in and out of the United States, and that by getting kind of trapdoor access to those switches through cooperation with some telecommunications companies, the NSA basically is able to get into the bloodstream of the American telecommunications network and able to eavesdrop on email and telephone calls as they are routed in and out of the country.
No, the way I understand it, the NSA has not necessarily been actually listening to all the phone calls or reading all the emails that it's monitoring. Part of what it's trying to do is to just find patterns. Who's calling who? Who's emailing who? Is that right?
Well, it does both. It does. It eavesdrops on individuals, some individuals. And then our understanding of it is that there's a broader aspect to this where they are conducting what some people call pattern analysis of looking at broader numbers of telecommunications to see when people are calling, how often they're getting called, what time of day they're getting called, and to try and develop some kind of trends that they can use in their investigations. But at the heart of the program, they are actually eavesdropping on individuals without search warrants. About 500 people at any one time inside the United States, and another 5 to 7,000 people overseas who are in communication with those people or who are involved with communications that are what they call transit traffic, which is a kind of arcane term to describe the communications that are routed through the United States telecommunications network, but which really are like a phone call or an email that's, say, going from Asia to Europe and just gets routed through the United States telecommunications network. In the past, because it was those communications were inside the United States, the NSA was not supposed to listen to those, at least not while it was being routed through the United States.
The Bush administration has been bypassing the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act, which says that you need to get a special warrant from a special court to tap phones or conduct surveillance on email. And the special court is supposed to respond immediately. Do you have any idea what the Bush administration standards have been to authorize this surveillance?
Well, what they've done in this case is, as you said, bypass the court. And that's the crux of the controversy, because that court was created in a law in 1978 specifically to deal with the kind of eavesdropping that they want to do now and that the NSA is doing, to provide search warrants, court-approved search warrants for national security electronic surveillance inside the United States against spies and terrorists. And the problem that they have in this case is that the administration says, well, we want to do so many of those and we want to do them so fast that the FISA court was ill-equipped to handle all of that. The critics of the administration argue that, you know, there are a number of ways that FISA could have handled this, and that there are also a number of ways that the Bush administration could have either gone to Congress or gone to the courts to seek approval for this, but they decided instead to do it on their own. The chief judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, who was a woman federal judge, had growing concerns about the program. And one of the reasons that she appeared to be concerned and that there were growing concerns within the Justice Department at that time was the potential that the government was seeking search warrants for eavesdropping on people in other cases that were not covered by the secret NSA program, but using as justification and evidence to get those warrants information that had been gathered through this warrantless search. In other words, there was a growing concern that possibly illegally obtained evidence from this NSA operation was being used then in courts to get search warrants in other cases. And so that concern was growing in 2004. And that was one of the issues, I think, that led both to the concerns by the chief judge of the FISA court, who had was only notified of the program and was never asked to approve it. And I think at the Justice Department. And that's a concern that's still there today. And after our story ran, one of the judges on the FISA court resigned because he'd never known about the program until our story ran, and is concerned about the possibility that search warrants have been issued based on potentially illegally obtained evidence.
Do you have any idea what standards the NSA has used to decide when it's appropriate for them to bypass the court and just directly conduct surveillance?
No. I mean, one of the things they've done in this program is that they've allowed NSA to decide on its own who to listen to. The NSA doesn't even have to get approval for each specific eavesdropping operation from the Justice Department or the White House or anybody else. For the first couple of years the program was in existence, it's our understanding that there weren't even any kind of checklist approved by the Justice Department for use by the NSA and deciding who to listen to. And there were a number of people in the government who began to get deeply concerned that there were virtually no management or oversight controls over the program. So in 2004, the program was briefly suspended because of those concerns, and finally the Justice Department began to audit the program in 2004, and they created a checklist in which they gave a checklist to the NSA to decide how to determine probable cause when and if they wanted to eavesdrop on somebody. But that checklist was something that NSA itself was then able to conduct on its own, and they didn't have to get any approvals. And so the real question, I think, in the conduct of this operation is that there's been no oversight, or virtually no oversight, either from within the Bush administration or from Congress or the courts.
After your book, State of War, was published, you reported that a top Justice Department official objected to parts of the program in 2004. And at the time, John Ashcroft, who was then the head of the Justice Department, was hospitalized for gallbladder surgery. He was in intensive care, which is why his top official was asked. And his name is James Comey. What do you know about why James Comey was unwilling to give his approval to certifying certain parts of the program, and do you know what parts they were?
No, we don't. We don't have a lot more detail of that, other than the fact that both Comey and Ashcroft raise concerns. One of the things that they, you know, the president has made the point publicly that he reauthorizes this program. I think he said something like every 45 days. Part of the reauthorization, as I understand it, is that the Attorney General has to recertify it roughly the same number of, the same period that the President does. And that there was, for some reason in 2004, a growing concern within the Justice Department about the lack of controls over the program, even though the program had been in existence by that time for a couple of years. And while Ashcroft was in the hospital, Comey was serving, I think it's accurate to say, he was serving as acting attorney general. His normal job is deputy attorney general. And I think it appears that the White House went to Comey for recertification of the program at the same time the president was reauthorizing it. And he apparently declined, and then which led to an extraordinary meeting, I think, with Andy Card, the White House Chief of Staff, and perhaps Alberto Gonzalez, the White House Counsel, going to the hospital to see Ashcroft to try and get him to recertify. It appears they eventually got recertification. The question is exactly what happened in that meeting and what was the level of concern by Ashcroft and Comey, and we don't really know the answer to that.
My guest is New York Times reporter James Risen. His new book is called State of War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter James Risen. Along with Times reporter Eric Lischblau, he broke the story of the National Security Agency's secret domestic surveillance program. Risen writes about that and other secret programs in his new book, State of War. How much do you know about how many Americans have been monitored as part of this NSA program and who has been monitored?
Well, what we've been told is that they have been eavesdropping without search warrants on approximately 500 people inside the United States at any one time since early 2002 or late 2001, and that number, those people change over time. The actual people rotate in and out of who are being eavesdropped on, and so we've been told that it's safe to assume that the number of people who've actually been targeted under this program is in the thousands. And that overseas, you know, the program has monitored 5,000 to 7,000 people at any one time. And they have been listening both to telephone and email traffic.
The Justice Department has asked for search logs from Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and America Online. Google has refused to hand those over. And the Justice Department wants this as part of to investigate online users of pornography. Do you see that case as being connected at all to the NSA investigation you've been conducting?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the real issues for the Bush administration, at least in the second term, is the nature and extent of their use of national security arguments to engage in domestic intelligence operations inside the United States. And there, we've seen a number of stories on a number of different fronts, including Pentagon domestic spying operations against anti-war protesters and other dissidents. When I think that, you know, one of the things we've really got to, I'm trying to report on now, is the extent to which there is a broader domestic intelligence operation that goes beyond just the NSA and what we've heard about.
What has for you been the most surprising result of your investigation into the secret NSA program? For example, now the Senate Judiciary Committee and Senate Intelligence Committees are planning hearings on the surveillance. There's a couple of court test cases that are about to begin. What are, as far as you're concerned, the most surprising results?
Well, I guess, you know, I think the biggest thing to me, Eric and I weren't sure anybody would really notice the story at first. You know, you never know when you write a story whether people will pay attention to it or not, and whether it'll have any impact or not. And I guess I've just been kind of stunned by the impact of it overall. And I wasn't sure what would happen. I think it's interesting to me that a number of conservatives have been upset by what the administration has been doing. And I think this is one of the few stories or few cases, I think, recently where the criticism and kind of the alignment of people on where they stand on this issue isn't quite so partisan as a number of other issues. And I guess that's slightly surprising to me, too.
When asked if this surveillance program might be an impeachable offense, you know, whether the president's authorization of this program might be an impeachable offense, Al Gore said that it might be. Do you think it might be an impeachable offense?
Oh, I don't know. You know, that's a political issue. An impeachment is a political process, and it's not really a legal process. And I'm just a reporter, so I don't get to vote on that one way or the other, so it doesn't really matter what I think. I think that it's interesting that this has, you know, stirred up so much emotion on both sides, and I think it's interesting that the president this week is going to make such an aggressive defense of it, and I think it's quite possible that once the whole debate on this, you know, plays out, that the American people will decide that this is a good thing for the president to do, and that he should keep on doing it. I'm just like to report on things and then let other people have the, you know, their political say.
You mentioned the how aggressive the Bush administration will be this week in supporting the program. There are high-placed people from the Bush administration who will be speaking about the program nearly every day this week. Have more people come forward from the NSA or from other sectors of the intelligence world since you and Eric Lischbrow broke this story to tell you more about what went on behind the scenes? In other words, are you getting more information as a result of having broken the story?
Well, I don't want to get into anything about sources, but I can say that we're still reporting on the story and we're still writing more stories and that, you know, we're able to continue to find out new things.
One person has come forward, Russell Tice, to say that he was one of the sources for your story, and my understanding is you've been unwilling to confirm or deny that. Why is that?
Well, I just don't. I just have a policy. I'm not going to discuss anything about my sources.
No. This person who I mentioned, Russell Tice, might be prosecuted for leaking information, and the president has said he wants to find out who leaked the information and prosecute them. Are you worried about your sources being prosecuted for leaking?
Well, I think the one thing that I feel strongly about is that this is a classic case of whistleblowers who have come forward for the right reasons, because they believe that something illegal and possibly unconstitutional was going on. Whether that is illegal and is unconstitutional is for other people to decide besides me, but that was how they felt. And they came forward in the best traditions, I think, of American democracy, because they felt that the American people really had to know about this in order to have a debate and a public discussion about it. And so I think these people were our patriots. And I think that any attempt by the government to target them or to go after them, I think, would be tragic.
James Risen is a New York Times reporter and author of the new book State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Risen will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and from Diane Wolfe of New York and Washington, D.C., in great appreciation of NPR's mission to create a more informed public. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how the CIA gave nuclear blueprints to the Iranians with errors intended to mislead them. We continue our conversation with James Risen about his new book on the secret history of the CIA and the Bush administration. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Miles Davis box set. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times reporter James Risen. He's one of the reporters who broke the story about the National Security Agency's secret domestic surveillance program. Risen writes about that and other secret programs in his new book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Many of the sources in his book are anonymous. I asked him about the difficulty of naming sources when writing about intelligence issues, particularly when covering the ultra-secretive NSA.
It's really a catch-22 because people will criticize you for using anonymous sources, but then if you name your sources, they could go to jail. And then that leaves you with the alternative of not writing anything about these agencies or these operations. And so I think that really the only alternative is to grant anonymity to people, and to do it in a way that, you know, you've got to be careful on how you do it and the sources you use. And I've learned over the years through hard experience, I think, how best to try to do that. It's not always easy, but I think it's absolutely essential, or you can't write about these things.
You say in the book that many of your sources in that you draw on for the book came to you or spoke to you because of their growing disillusionment. What can you tell us about what was disillusioning your sources with the way intelligence was run? And these are sources both in the NSA and in the CIA.
I think one of the things that struck me when I first started working on this book, and it's not just in the intelligence community, but throughout the Bush administration, that people I was meeting, a lot of them, many of them who had recently left the Bush administration over the last year or two, you looked at them and they had a dazed look as if they'd just been in a car crash and like they were trying to sort out what had happened. And I got a sense from people, a number of people who were, you know, just leaving the administration, that they were really wondering themselves what went wrong. And I was thinking after a while that this must have been what it was like during the Vietnam War, when a lot of people started leaving the Nixon and Johnson administrations during Vietnam. And I think there's a lot, that's one of the parallels, not that Iraq and Vietnam are similar, but that the experience within the government for, say, mid-level professionals, I think in many ways is similar, that they are still today, after leaving government, still trying to sort out what exactly happened to them and what happened to the government. And it was fascinating to see that, because I think there was as they look back, a number of these people feel like something went wrong, but they're not quite sure what. And so that's what I was trying to sort out.
Did sources tell you that they ever felt pressured by the Bush administration to report selectively on the intelligence that they had, or to suppress intelligence that would contradict Bush administration positions?
Well, there was one. That's one of the big questions everybody's been wondering about since, you know, the failure to find WMD. And what I think what I concluded was that people felt a climate within the CIA, particularly among the analysts and the people dealing with Iraq WMD. There was a climate created that you knew what the right answer was. You knew the answer people wanted to hear. Nobody ever wrote a memo saying this is the answer, but you knew what the answer was. And if you came up with an intelligence report that said there was, you know, that somehow confirmed the existence of WMD, you knew that that report went right to the top. And that if you raised skepticism about any aspects of the intelligence, that you were either ignored or shunted off to the side. And one of the things that I've tried to make clear in the book, and I hope I have, is that it's not clear that anybody lied. I don't think the president ever lied about the existence of WMD. I don't think George Tenet lied. I don't think anybody lied. I think they believed that there was WMD. I know that they believed that there was WMD. What the problem was different. What I think the problem was that a number of people inside the CIA, a number of senior professionals believed, they assumed there was WMD, but they also knew that the intelligence proving that case was not very good. They knew that the CIA did not have strong intelligence to corroborate what the Bush administration was saying publicly, even though they assumed that it was right. And the people who raised doubts about the quality of the intelligence, not the existence of WMD, but the quality of the underlying intelligence, were either ignored or shunted to the side.
The White House asked the New York Times, because this information was published in the New York Times before it was published in your book, just shortly before. The White House asked the New York Times not to publish your article, arguing that it could jeopardize continuing investigations and alert would-be terrorists that they might be under scrutiny. Now, you had gathered this information about a year before it was published in the Times, so the Times held it for about a year. There have been a lot of questions about why the Times held it so long and why did they publish it when they did? Were they afraid that they were going to be scooped by their own reporter when your book was published? I know in the past you've been unwilling to discuss this. Any chance you're willing to talk about it today?
No, I just think that, you know, to me, this when the New York Times published this, I think it was a great public service, and it was something that has started a national debate on the substance of this issue, and I just think that that's the important point. And people who criticize the Times forget that we're the ones who broke the story. And I didn't see anybody else breaking that story, so.
My guest is New York Times reporter James Risen. His new book is called State of War. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter James Risen. Along with Times reporter Eric Lischblau, he broke the story of the National Security Agency's secret domestic surveillance program. Risen writes about that and other secret programs in his new book, State of War. There are several other pretty controversial programs that you've uncovered here. What did you think was going to be the most controversial when you were on the verge of publishing the book?
Well, I guess the NSA operation I figured would be the most controversial. You know, there's a number of other things in there that are interesting. One of them relates to President Bush and whether or not he was briefed formally and officially briefed by the CIA on the details of the agency's enhanced interrogation techniques that they use in their secret prisons around the world.
Well, you suggest in the book that you think members of the Bush administration intentionally did not tell the president about interrogation techniques so that the president would have deniability.
Yeah, I think what I was told was that the CIA Inspector General's staff was told that the president was not formally briefed on the details of the interrogation techniques, and that Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and a few other senior aides were briefed, but that they didn't. There was a sense that he didn't want to go into the Oval Office and go into graphic detail about these specific techniques, and I think there were people at the CIA who later regretted that they didn't look the president in the eye and go over these in detail.
Why do you think they regretted it?
Well, because now it's a big controversy over the use of harsh interrogation techniques, mm-hmm. and the torture debate and the debate over secret prisons. Although they did get, you know, the administration approved the use of these techniques. The question really is not over their approval, and it's more a matter of did the president want some kind of deniability so then he could go out and say, you know, I never authorized torture. And I think one of the issues for the CIA is that the CIA was the only agency that actually got such, you know, got high-level approval for the actions it was taking. But the techniques that were in use there, I think somehow one of the things that I've really been interested in trying to understand is how You began to use harsh interrogation techniques first against Al-Qaeda captives in CIA custody. And then 6 months or a year later, we end up having a scandal in a military-run facility in Iraq where there's questions about interrogation techniques. And the question that's never been adequately answered is did something migrate away from CIA to the military, or how did that all happen where suddenly, for the first time in modern history, the U.S. military is being accused of such broad mistreatment of prisoners?
I want to ask you about another program that you write about in your book, State of War. And this relates to something in the news right now, which is that Iran is continuing with its nuclear program in spite of the protests from the international community. You wrote about a program called Merlin. What was this program?
Well, back in 2000, about 6 years ago, the CIA arranged for a Russian defector to give nuclear blueprints to the Iranians, and they were supposedly flawed blueprints. And the idea behind the operation was to try and get the Iranians to build a nuclear weapon based on these flawed blueprints, and then that it would be a dud. But the operation was considered not to have been handled well, and it's not clear really whether the blueprints actually aided the Iranians rather than tried to set them back. And so there's been questions raised about how effective and how well managed this was.
Because this is supposed to be blueprints with flaws that would mislead them, but some of the information in there was real information. The story about how the mistake was probably corrected by mistake.
Well, what I was told is that the Russian defector could tell immediately that that there were flaws in the blueprints, and that he was not supposed to know that these were flawed. And so
this is the Russian defector who is supposed to be leaving these plans for the Iranians to see.
Right. Right. And so the questions really raised was if he could see it, and he even sent them a letter saying sent the Iranians a letter saying, you will see that there are, I forget the exact wording of the letter, but you will see that, there are problems, and you'll need more help or something like that. And so the question really is, did the Iranians, were they able to parse these designs and find the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff? They have plenty of Russian and Chinese nuclear scientists who consult with them, who could have helped them with this. And even more importantly, A.Q. Khan and his network gave the Iranians nuclear blueprints on their own some time ago. And so this operation probably was irrelevant to the larger debate, but it showed raised real questions about the CIA's handling of WMD intelligence and whether or not they really know what they're doing when they are talking, especially after Iraq, after we've seen how wrong they were about everything about Iraq's weapons programs.
Was this Merlin program controversial within the CIA?
Well, it was pretty secret, so I don't think there was too much controversy, but there are people who've raised questions about it.
And you also tell the story of an email that inadvertently ended up exposing all of the CIA spies that were in Iran. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, this happened in 2004. There was they had some kind of covert communications procedures to communicate with a whole network of spies that the CIA had in Iran. And a CIA officer communicating through this network with only one spy accidentally downloaded information on that could help identify the entire network to this, and downloaded it to this one agent. What I was told was that this did disrupt the entire network. The CIA now claims, no, we've done a big damage assessment and found out that this didn't lead to arresting them all. They've said that since my book came out. But they don't deny that this huge mistake happened, and that there was that they've had to do one of the biggest damage assessments in their history to determine the status of their Iranian network. Clearly, it put their entire spy network in Iran at great risk, at a minimum.
President Bush has said about your investigation into the NSA program, my personal opinion is that it was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in a time of war. The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy. What would you say to President Bush about that?
Well, I would say that throughout American history, we've had a debate over the balancing between national security and civil liberties, and that that debate has always ranged, you know, there's a spectrum of things between the erosion of the privacy rights of American citizens versus the needs of to secure the country. And that debate has gone back to, you know, the earliest days of the Republic, and it continues today. And I think that's a debate we are going to continue to have. And so I would say that it's important for the public to be able to understand what its government is doing in order to have that debate.
What's it like for you now to have the country talking about your story and your book, to have the president criticizing it, to have your sources possibly facing indictment? You might be subpoenaed yourself. I mean, there's just so much controversy swirling around you right now. I think a lot of reporters try to stay out of the story as much as possible, shine the light on the story and on the people they're writing about, but there's so much light shining on you right now.
Well, I try not to think about it.
Is that hard?
until you just said it that way. I hadn't thought of it that way. I just trying to keep doing stories. And
surely you must feel the heat.
Well, you know, my job is to write newspaper stories, so I'm continuing to try and do that, and just keep doing that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
James Risen is a New York Times reporter and author of the new book, State of War. Our interview was recorded this morning. Here's trombonist Roswell Rudd playing a boogie-woogie with a Mongolian band from Rudd's new CD, Blue Mongol. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Miles Davis box set of his 1970 sessions at the club The Cellar Door. This is Fresh Air. In 1968, trumpeter Miles Davis was leading an exploratory jazz group. By 1972, he was playing hardcore funk. In December 1970, Davis's music was somewhere in the middle when he took a band into Washington, D.C.'s Cellar Door for his last recordings in a nightclub setting. A new box set collects most of the music recorded that week. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Miles Davis got a wah-wah pedal in 1970. Skeptics asked, why not just play electric guitar? After all, the pedal had been invented so guitarists could mimic the wah-wah effects jazz trumpeters got with plunger mute. Miles's wah-wah had a different character, reason enough to justify it. But he did seem intent on remaking his horn as a guitar. He'd attack one note like a flat picker about to break a string. Miles had admired Jimi Hendrix enough to attend his funeral in 1970, and there were moments during the trumpeter's four nights at a Washington club a couple of months later where he sounded like he wanted to be Hendrix, riding a wave of feedback. No jazz musician acted more like a rock star than Miles, cranking up the volume, dressing like a fop, and recording live at the Fillmore. He told Jack DeJohnette to play like Hendrix's drummer, Buddy Miles. A few months before this Washington gig, the trumpeter had replaced jazz bassist Dave Holland with a funky 19-year-old bass guitarist, Michael Henderson, whom he'd stolen from Stevie Wonder. It's still a bit shocking how the trumpeter with a pretty and vulnerable tone embraced the whole loud, distorted electric thing, the crunchy sound of temperamental electric pianos in particular. The keyboard player here is another jazz musician esteemed for his handmade acoustic sound, Keith Jarrett. Jarrett has said he felt like the only member of the band on Davis's wavelength, even if Miles had told bassist Henderson to stay funky and not follow Jarrett into jazz territory. This leads to bizarre moments when the musicians play like they're in different rooms. In this case, Jarrett, Michael Henderson, and the meandering Brazilian percussionist Ayerto. Jarrett's right when he says Davis hadn't totally transformed his jazz group into a funk band, yet. And there were still a few free jazzy freakouts left over from an earlier lineup. So the group pulls in several directions, but it's a mess in a good way, like a Jackson Pollock. Davis had been working this sextet with Gary Bartz on saxophones for a couple of months before they recorded in Washington. A fraction of this music was released in mangled form ages ago on the album Live Evil. That stuff had come from the last of four nights, when guitarist John McLaughlin was plopped into the band. A jazz picker with a raunchy tone, McLaughlin ups the ante while being careful not to step on Jarrett's toes. His lines can sound oddly like what Miles was reaching for on processed trumpet, which goes to show, if you really want to sound like a guitar, get a guitarist. We'll be right back. John McLaughlin adds such extra oomph to the last two discs here, we probably don't need four sets of warm-up material from before he showed up. All told, the Miles Davis box, The Cellar Door Sessions, 1970, includes six sets out of the 10 recorded that week. Three or four might have been enough, from an artistic, if not marketing, viewpoint.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Miles Davis, The Cellar Door Sessions, 1970. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from American Experience with John and Abigail Adams, the story of an original American power couple, tonight on PBS and at pbs.org. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Emancipator's Wife, a novel of Mary Todd Lincoln by Barbara Hambly. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Director Steven Soderbergh's new film Bubble comes out on Friday. It'll be broadcast on HDTV the same day and available on DVD 4 days later. On the next Fresh Air, Soderbergh talks about the film and what some are calling movie business heresy. He also directed Ocean's 11 and Traffic and co-produced Syriana. Join us for the next Fresh Air.